Support for Bite Marks Cafe comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor PCAT, Pacific Center for Advanced Technology Training.
Welcome to the new reality edition of Bite Marks Cafe right here on Hawaii Public Radio, where we serve you the first bite of today's science, technology, and innovation. I'm Bert Lum, and on today's show, we have Amy Zhao. She's the policy and partnership strategist over at the Emua Alliance, and she's here to talk about digital safety. Amy, welcome to Bite Marks Cafe.
Thank you for having me.
And Amy, you know, you are pretty well known. I mean, you got, you know, some articles in the Civil Beat, and I'm going to want to ask you some questions about that. But you're a young person. I want to give you a chance to tell us a little bit about, you know, what you do and how you got into this. And I'll leave it to you to tell us, you know, where are you going high school?
Yeah, my name is Amy Zhao. I'm currently a senior at Iolani, and I'm also a youth advocate focused on digital safety, sexual exploitation, and championing gender justice. I'm also someone who creates a lot of content online, so I've seen kind of both sides of, like, social media, you know, being a platform for creativity and community and even activism, but at the same time being a space that can enable a lot of harassment, exploitation, and these safety concerns. So that sort of tension is what motivated me in my work on digital safety. And this fall, I'll be attending Columbia, where I plan to continue working at the intersection of policy, tech, and human rights. And I'm especially passionate about making sure young people like myself are safe, not just in our real life communities, but also online, which is where so much of our lives now exists.
So, Amy, how did you, as a young person, a student, you know, when I was a student, I never thought of any of this kind of stuff. But how did you get into this? Was there something that inspired you to really take the banner and you know, sort of lead the charge?
Yeah, I would say I was quite literally thrown into the digital space from a very, very young age. I remember, I think it was as young as fifth grade, I had, you know, social media, I had Instagram, mm-hmm. I had TikTok, and, you know, I was really involved on that side, kind of having fun. But, you know, as I started posting more content, that visibility kind of came at a cost with hate comments, kind of these DMs. And, like, I realized that a lot of, like, the violence that I experienced online, it wasn't just, like, pure mean. Some of it was, but a lot of it was also gendered. So I kind of saw this connection between gender violence and this sort of online digital culture that enables it, kind of this, you know, hidden misogyny behind these jokes and internet memes. And that's when I started realizing, hey, like, this is something that I want to speak up about, because I don't think enough people are talking about the gender violence that, you know, a lot of girls like myself and my friends are experiencing on these digital spaces. Mm-hmm. And then I also started kind of, you know, being intrigued by the architecture behind social media, kind of like these features like infinite scroll, you know, algorithm tailoring. Why mm-hmm. is my feed, you know, so hyper-tailored to my interests while, you know, someone else can have completely different things? And how does that play a part into, like, the values that are fed into people my age? And, you know, how does that play a part into something like gender violence? So I think thinking about asking all of these questions, I realized that this was something that I didn't just want to kind of sit back and take in, but I wanted to actively, you know, advocate for my rights on these digital platforms and also for my friends and so many other, you know, millions of teens who are using these platforms.
So in school, you said fifth grade, but then when did you actually start thinking that maybe you ought to start being a voice and actually writing articles and getting involved with Emua Alliance?
I think that was around the end of sophomore year. Mm-hmm. And it was, you know, I kind of started learning about human trafficking, which is a lot of the work that Emua Alliance works to, you know, to eliminate exploitation in the trafficking world. But, you know, as I was working on these policies to eliminate trafficking and to eliminate exploitation, I realized that a lot of the tactics that were kind of used by, you can say, like, traffickers or pimps, They're all, you know, based, a lot of them are based online. And they're also some of, like, the same techniques or same, like, values that is in a lot of digital violence that I saw mm-hmm. As someone who's, you know, chronically on the internet. And so I kind of made a connection there. And I think around the beginning of senior year or end of junior year, that's when I really wanted to, you know, represent MUA Alliance and also champion this sort of digital safety side of advocating for gender justice.
Yeah, because and maybe you can share a little bit about what eMUA Alliance does, because that's more targeting or addressing the issue around trafficking, right?
Right. So at eMUA, we're an organization focused on bridging the gap between lived experience and policy. So a big part of our work is recognizing that, you know, digital harm is a form of gender-based violence in many cases. So we focus on issues specifically like image-based abuse, online exploitation, and making sure platforms and laws actually protect people in today's digital reality. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that is because it's directly connected to something like human trafficking, because traffickers, you know, use these online spaces to recruit, to exploit young people, that, you know, they can sense people's vulnerabilities from these online spaces, which is why digital literacy and digital safety is so important, because it's connected to a lot of like the gender violence work that we're doing too. So we do that by, you know, drafting legislation, educating lawmakers, and making sure that youth voices like mine and my classmates are part of these decisions that directly affect our lives on the digital world.
I'm curious, and we'll get to talk about some policy later on in the show, but you are very much a well-educated, well-spoken about, you know, this topic. I mean, how would you describe your classmates, and are they interested in this as well, or are they generally saying, oh yeah, Amy, you go for it, and you know, protect the rest of us?
Yeah, I would say there's definitely a mix of both. I would say that, you know, most people who use social media are somewhat aware of there's a lot of flaws about it, mm-hmm. whether it's the addiction that comes with it, you know, whether it's, you know, these videos that are generating misinformation. But I think not enough people my age or just in general are taking the next step of, okay, but what can be done to hold the social media companies accountable? What can be done to actually prevent this violence on digital spaces? And I think that's really hard, because a lot of, for example, the gender violence that are being, you know, kind of circumvented on social media, it's really hard to spot because they're part of this pop culture that's, you know, kind of, oh, memes and jokes. It can just be like a video that appears funny. But if you ask the deeper questions of why is this algorithm sending me this video, and what is that mean, like what are the values behind this video, you know, maybe it could just be a gym video, but it's promoting kind of these ideals that, you know, women are objects or you know, some sort of misogyny, but it on the surface level we don't kind of spot that directly as a form of digital violence, which is I think a lot of the reason why people are kind of not speaking up as much about mm-hmm. the gender violence that happens online, just because it's so embedded into our culture, internet culture, and our pop culture.
I'm curious, you know, at Iolani, does the administration, what is their general position on, let's say, the topic of AI and the use of AI? And I know it's a little divergent from, you know, the topic of our conversation, but generally speaking, how does the school feel about the use of AI?
Yeah, so I know that our school has, I think, some sort of a student working group that is working on, you know, educating students on how to use AI ethically. But in terms of kind of the more policy side of that, I'm not exactly sure on our school's, you know, position on that. But I've definitely seen our school, there's efforts to try to encourage more dialogue around AI. But at the same time, I do see a lot of gaps, especially in addressing how AI and algorithms play part into, you know, issues like gender violence or political polarization. And I think there could be more dialogue mm-hmm. about it at school.
Well, you know, I do want to give you a chance to talk a little bit about the article that you wrote in Civil Beat and maybe the, you know, some of the feedback that you got as a result of that. So we'll hold that thought. We'll be right back after this short break to continue our conversation with Amy Zhao, policy and partnership strategist over at eMUA Alliance. This is Bite Marks Cafe.
Support for Bite Marks Cafe comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor The Hidden Nene.
Welcome back. This is Bite Marks Cafe right here on Hawaii Public Radio, HPR 1. I'm Bert Lum. And if you're joining us, we're talking to Amy Zhao. She's the policy and partnership strategist over at eMUA Alliance. And we're talking about digital safety. And you know, this topic of digital safety, Amy, obviously is very important to you, to the extent that you wrote a really good article in Civil Beat, and it kind of got me interested in you and what you're helping to advocate for. Tell us a little bit about, you know, what prompted, well, I think I know what prompted the article, but what was the general feedback that you got as a result of that?
Yeah, so I heard from a lot of people after the article, especially a lot of young women and teens and survivors saying that, hey, like, that's exactly what I've experienced online. And you've kind of put this hidden feeling that I've had about digital violence online into, you know, words on paper. And there was also a lot of just strong support from community members who didn't realize how widespread these issues were online. Mm-hmm. And I think it showed that people in general are ready for change about, you know, promoting digital violence online. And they just need more awareness and stronger laws from our legislature.
So that topic of ready for change, and you just sort of hinted at policy work. What sort of change do you see happening or needing to happen in addition to policy? There's a whole idea of you know, you get government involved and it's going to take a while. And I'd love to hear your thoughts on, you know, like SB 3001 and, you know, how do you actually see that being not only policed, but enforced, right? But at the same time, what do you want people to actually start thinking about doing in addition to the policy work?
Yeah, thank you, Bert, for bringing that up, because I think that's a really important part of the conversation. Like I mentioned before, a lot of these social media algorithms, they're, you know, hyper-tailored to people's individual interests, and they kind of put people into these almost like echo chambers of mm-hmm. thought. So the problem with that is a lot of this misogyny that I'm talking about that's hidden behind internet memes and jokes, they're fed into echo chambers into a lot of young men my age, and it kind of, you know, it kind of sends this message of gender violence in such an isolated way that it can shape someone's values at such a young age, right? Mm-hmm. So as advocates, what I think we can do is we can reclaim these digital spaces, and I hate to say it, but use these algorithmic techniques to our advantage. So as someone who also posts activism videos to combat gender violence online, I kind of take into account how the algorithm works, how do I capture viewers' attention, and how do I make short-form content to advocate for women's rights, to advocate for gender justice in a way that, you know, will work well with the algorithm. So I think that's part of what we can do as advocates, is to reclaim digital spaces and use it to our advantage, because if the game is going to be played where we have to, you know, play into these algorithmic, you know, formulas, then I say that as advocates, we need to be aware of that, and we need to use that to our advantage, because digital spaces are real spaces and they shape people's values, political beliefs, and, you know, we can normalize violence. And using these algorithm techniques to kind of counter misogyny mm-hmm. Will really work to, you know, as advocates to empower women and to, you know, hold people accountable online.
So can you give me an example, and maybe, you know, what's your favorite platform? Are you on, I'm sure you're on Instagram. Are you on TikTok? I mean, what do you use primarily? And give us an example of helping people sort of reclaim the storyline and reclaim, you know, the algorithm that starts to feed you on a regular basis. What would be an example of that?
Yeah, so on Emua Alliance's Instagram, which is just Emua Alliance, I've made a lot of Instagram reels mm-hmm. that are about spreading awareness of exploitation, of human trafficking, of, you know, gender violence online. And a lot of the techniques that I use are, you know, they're playing into the algorithm. So I recently made this reel where, you know, I kind of incorporated the first 5 seconds with some sort of attention-grabbing line, and then I had kind of various different clips, short clips to grab people's attention. And I always want to make sure that my videos are, you know, like on the shorter side, because that's just how kind of like the short form algorithm game is played. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, making these videos and recognizing that a lot of what the information that people my age consume is on platforms like TikTok or Instagram, for better or worse, recognizing that though, and realizing that as advocates, we have to send our messages in a way that is adaptive to our digital environment, is I think a really important tool that people can use to kind of counter this digital violence and misogyny online.
You must spend a fair amount of time. I mean, I know when I do, and I'm pretty much real basic user of things like Instagram. I mean, I'll post a photo, a bunch of photos, and I'll spend some time thinking about the right, you know, thing to say about that this set of photos. But when you start to do really, you know, sort of like the design of how you want to do the short form reels, that must take a bit of, you know, video editing and architecting and scripting. There's a lot of thought that goes into that. How much time do you have to spend to actually develop that capability, that technique?
Yeah, well, as I was like saying before, I've been basically chronically online ever since I was a really, really young teen. And so a lot of it comes from watching other creators, whether mm-hmm. that's, you know, makeup creators or dance creators, and kind of like over the years, like, you know, kind of just learning the different techniques that they've used, whether it's playing with like captions, like using different music. And honestly, a lot of it came naturally because I really grew up, and I think a lot of people in my generation can relate to this, in an age where the digital space is quite literally our real life space. So a lot of everything that I've learned is from actually just using social media. But I think that, you know, for someone who wants to start getting into advocacy on digital spaces, you can check out, you know, our account on Instagram, the Woo Alliance, and there's so many other, you know, activist organizations, feminist organizations on Instagram, on TikTok, who are advocating for women's rights, for gender justice, while playing the algorithm game.
Do you actually, I think it would be kind of great, I would be the first one to attend a class that you hold on producing some of these short form reels, so that you could kind of, you know, get your message out there and get it, you know, sort of accepted by the algorithm to spread it around. I mean, that's a technique in and of itself. So when are you going to have your class?
Yeah, I love that idea.
Are you going to hold a class before you graduate and leave for Columbia?
I will have to steal that idea. I love it.
Well, no, that's good. So when your article came out and people were responding to you and you were giving them some suggestions, obviously we'll talk a little bit about policy, but, you know, in the act of getting people to start creating these kinds of reels to help the algorithm, you know, sort of populate the message, did you get adopters? I mean, did you get people that are interested in maybe taking that challenge on?
Yeah, I think it definitely, the article definitely encouraged a lot of discussions about, you know, what types of actions we can take to actually regulate kind of the algorithm and the things behind that. And I think that a lot of what, you know, the legislation around it can be complex, but I believe that if we can require some sort of a transparency of these algorithms and how they actually work, and allow more experts to research kind of how these algorithms are tailored and to what extent do algorithms perpetuate gender violence or, you know, political polarization, I think that might be an important first step that we can take mm-hmm. to kind of address these issues. But I do think that there's still a lot of discussion to be done in this area.
So I do want to give you a chance to talk a little bit about you know, a bill that this passed, I think one of the final readings, and it's SB 3001, and it is really kind of really in the sweet spot of what you're talking about, and it really I think started from these AI bots and how people form relationships, you know, with some of the AI bots, and they may not even realize that, you know, it's an AI bot. And I think this piece of legislation helps to clarify or establish some regulations around that. So I want to hold that thought. We'll be right back at this short break to continue our conversation with Amy Zhao. She's the policy and partnership strategist over at Emua Alliance. This is Bite Marks Cafe.
Support for Bite Marks Cafe comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Furniture Plus Design.
Welcome back. This is Bite Marks Cafe. I'm Bert Lum right here on Hawaii Public Radio, HPR1. And if you're just joining us, we're talking to Amy Zhao. She's the policy and partnership strategist over at Emua Alliance. Also a senior at Iolani. I want to definitely mention that because that's where I went. But she's also going to Columbia, which is great. Now, Amy, so the storyline behind this particular legislation, I know there were a couple of bills that were, you know, going through the legislature this session. This one stemmed from, I guess, a real life happening here in Hawaii where somebody was interacting with with an AI bot, and the AI bot, it was kind of like a relationship kind of thing, and the AI bot, got kind of, how would you describe it? I mean, it got very, not only intimate, but it was, it was leading the person down a very dangerous path. Could you describe this, I guess, a scenario, situation that actually arose, and that really kind of was what resulted in this particular bill?
Right. So I think I'm not familiar with that particular story, but I think with AI chatbots, the risk is that because the algorithm is designed to basically continuously stimulate ongoing emotional relationship and conversations, like the goal is to keep the user, engaged mm-hmm. in this conversation, a lot of the safeguards around mental health and kind of the advice that these AI chatbots are giving, it was kind of blurry prior to this bill. So with SB 3001, the AI Disclosure and Safety Act, this bill is trying to prevent the manipulative tactics that platforms, AI chatbots use to kind of create emotional dependency with the user and kind of blur boundaries or, we really want the bill, what it really does is tries to promote mental health wellness and prevent these chatbots from actually, blurring boundaries in mental health and kind of developing these emotionally dependent relationships with users.
Now, given the AI bot, and maybe you can, if you have some examples in mind, but, the bill basically requires some transparency on disclosing the fact that it is AI, and it's not a human on the other end of that that discussion. What are some of the things that, I guess, the first thing I'm curious about is, are these major platforms like, like Meta or, I think there's the ones that I use, ChatGPT and Gemini, those are more, sort of interactive. But the ones that are actually creating sort of this relationship interface, what platforms are we referring to? And these are done by, major business corporations. But I'm not, I want to ask you, what are some examples of some of those platforms?
Right. I actually think that platforms like ChatGPT or Gemini are actually, these like AI companion platforms, because a lot of people are, increasingly going to ChatGPT, going to Gemini for advice on, relationship problems, on advice on, personal decisions. And, we can have a whole other conversation about the privacy concern that goes into that. But mm-hmm. it's also the fact that, these chatbots, they're designed to keep users engaged in the conversation. They're not, a licensed mental health therapist. They're not an expert, but they're designed to keep the user engaged. And with this bill, what we're hoping to do is, instead of the AI doing everything to kind of keep the user engaged, if, say, a teen expresses a suicidal, intention on an AI chatbot, the AI must refer them to crisis services under this bill, such as a hotline or crisis test. It can't simply stay silent or try to keep the conversation engaged without actually physically referring the user to a hotline or a crisis service.
So I would imagine that some of these AI chatbots, they're sort of wraparound delivery mechanisms that have perhaps, some of the things that we're familiar with, whether it's ChatGPT or Gemini on the back end, these wraparound chatbots, they could be built by, let's say, local businesses, let's say a tech startup, or they could be coming in from, the continent. How would you envision this particular bill regulating how these wraparound chatbots get delivered into the Hawaii market?
I'm not completely sure on the answer to that, but I think what this bill can do is it can ensure that if someone is trying to go to an AI chatbot for, advice on their mental health, mm-hmm. on their relationship, the chatbot can make it clear to the user that, hey, I am not a licensed therapist. For, problems that you're experiencing, you must reach out to this number, or you should call this hotline, or, there needs to be some sort of indication to the user that the AI is not a licensed professional and that it cannot provide them with advice on mental health. And this is exactly what the bill requires for, you know, any platform in our state that is an AI chatbot.
Yeah, so I would imagine that, and this is where, I would follow this bill and see how it actually gets implemented, because at some point in time, if it does turn into a law, any of these applications that are being used by a user in Hawaii would be required to comply to this regulation. And what I'd be personally curious about is, you know, who's actually the regulator and who's the enforcer of, let's say chatbot XYZ. It's available on the internet. You don't know necessarily where it's actually manufactured or developed. Could be Silicon Valley, but how does that actually get? Who's overseeing the use of it and regulating it and actually enforcing that regulation? So anyway, that's not a question for you to answer, but that's something that I think we'll need to watch for. You know, as this bill moves on and ultimately, if it becomes a law, that's something that we would be definitely kind of like paying attention to. So with that, now Amy, you know, in terms of the work that you do, the articles you write, the testimony that you provide, these are great. I mean, and you're a great example of taking it to the advocacy level. What is your kind of call to action for others to perhaps get involved? And how do we start this conversation and expand it so that more voices are adding to the crescendo that you started?
Right. Well, I think the first step is that realizing that the information that we consume, whether it's on Reels, TikTok, YouTube Shorts, it's all based on an algorithm that kind of tailors this information to keep us engaged. It's not necessarily the right information and the values that we should be fed. But I think the first step is to recognize kind of the exploitative nature of algorithms. And I think what we can do next is after realizing that our digital spaces are very much our real spaces that shape people's values, political beliefs, and can normalize gender violence, we can push for lawmakers, whether it's at the state legislature or maybe even at the federal level, to pass stronger protections on algorithm transparency. We need to learn more about how these algorithms actually work. Tech companies need to, be held accountable, and our communities need to take this seriously because digital spaces are our real spaces. So I would say, get informed, speak up, support the policies that protect people against gender violence, against, privacy concerns, and really try to, get informed, be mindful of the things that we're consuming, and advocate for policies that can hold these platforms accountable for the harm that they've done.
Now, are you, as you graduate, go to Columbia, I mean, is there somebody that's going to take the baton from you at Iolani and kind of continue the work that you started?
I hope that, everyone, every young person can take this baton, because I think this is truly, an issue that is not going to go away anytime soon. If anything, we're becoming more and more reliant on these digital spaces. So I think as any person, young person engaged, in the digital world, we need to all speak up and, be mindful of the harms that it are on digital spaces, so, and the ways that we can hold them.
Amy, where can people go to find out more information about the work that you've done?
emualliance.org or Emua Alliance on Instagram.
Very good. Amy Zhao is the policy and partnership strategist over at Emua Alliance. I'll put that link up on the show notes later on. Amy, I want to thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you for listening to Bite Marks Cafe. Join us next week when we'll talk with tech savvy teens. If you miss any part of this edition, you can find the podcast of tonight's show on bitemarkscafe.org. Our engineer is David Chong. And you can catch us on HPR1 every Friday or anytime via the HPR app or your favorite podcast application. In the meantime, you stay safe. You stay awesome. We'll see you next week on another edition of Bite Marks Cafe.
Support for Bite Marks Cafe comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor PCAT, Pacific Center for Advanced Technology Training.